Well, it is good to see everyone this morning on the way in. I hope that you picked up a handout sheet. If you didn't get one, you'll need to go back there and grab one. You'll find it very, very helpful as we work through the Gospel of Luke this morning. Facebook is a very interesting novelty, maybe, a very interesting advancement in the life of what it means to be human, certainly in the United States, and I think even around the world. I find it very interesting when I receive friend requests from people I do not know. I receive friend requests from people in India. I have no idea who they are. Maybe I met them, maybe not. Maybe they are those who were friends with somebody else and somebody else said, hey, do you know this American pastor? And on and on it went, and here we are. Or I receive friend requests from some of Michael's college buddies, and I find out that they send me the friend request and it's a joke and they just want to see if I'll actually accept the friend request. And, you know, maybe you've had that experience too. The whole idea of Facebook is rather intriguing to me because it does cry out to something that is true in the human person. This desire, this innate need to be connected with people. It really is behind virtually everything that happens within the human culture as relates to some kind of groups. For example, why do quilting clubs exist? And have you ever, ladies, ever been part of a quilting club? None of you have. I haven't either, but I know people who have been a part of a quilting club, and I'm thinking, why does one need to be part of a club to quilt? Do you have to have multiple people there? And I suppose somebody would say to me, well, it's helpful. And anyone can correct me. You're free to do that. It's helpful if you have many people working on one quilt at a time. And I suppose that's true. But I do know that you can accomplish the making of a quilt without the benefit of a club. I do know that. Why do car clubs exist? Why do people play bridge every week? Did you know that there was a time that churches had bowling alleys in their buildings? In fact, there still is a church in St. Paul that has either two or three lanes. I don't remember which. Two or three lanes. And you can go to that church and be a part of a bowling league at that particular church. Now, why would a church put a bowling alley in their basement? What's the point of that? Why do bowling leagues exist at all? I remember when I was a kid, my mom and dad, when I was very young, my mom and dad would bowl every Friday night. My mom was very, 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 very good. Our house was filled with trophies as a child of all of these bowling leagues and tournaments that my mom won when I was very young. But going to a being a part of a bowling league is not always about just rolling the ball down the lane and striking the pins. It really is about the connection that you sense with the other people on your team or the people in your league. When we look in the New Testament, the Bible presents the church in a number of different words, pictures. The church is a body, the church is a building, and the church is a family. One of the questions that we raise, you consider being a family, is how does one become a part of the family? Well, looking at all of you, many of you, some of you have spouses, others of you hope to have a spouse someday, and so Katie wasn't always Katie Pitts. She used to be Katie Morrison, and then she became a part of the Pitts family via marriage. And then to that union was brought this new child, Sophia, and she was born into the family. And so you become a part of the family in different ways. If you want to be a part of the Pitts family, you might marry into the family. You might be born to one who are already a part of the family, but you become a part of the family that particular way. How does someone become a part of God's family? How does someone become a part of this bigger idea that God is doing? And that's what the book of Luke really is about. The book of Luke answers the question, how do people become a part of what God is doing? Someone might answer, well, you become a part of what God is doing by being of the right ethnicity or nationality. if you are one of the Jewish race, then you might become a part of what God is doing. Someone else might answer, you can become a part of what God is doing if you're part of the religious elite. If you're a member of the clergy, if you're a member of the priesthood, that might get you into what God is doing. The book of Luke answers the question, how do you become a part of what God is doing? And it shatters all of those possible answers. And it gives you an answer that if you didn't know the story, which most of you do, if you didn't know the story, you would sit back and you would say, that's really interesting at the minimum. On the outside, you might say, I didn't see that coming. That is way out there. How could that possibly happen? So this morning, we are continuing in our study of the New Testament, our New Testament survey, with Luke's gospel today. So if you have your Bible, if you turn to Luke chapter 1, let's begin some examination of this particular gospel book. If you didn't get a handout sheet, you're really going to want one. If you didn't get one on your way in, they are on the lectern in the back. Please grab one of those handout sheets. It will help you as we work our way through this morning. A little bit of background on Luke's gospel. Luke is, by profession, a physician. He writes both the Gospel of Luke and the book of Acts. As far as authorship, neither the Gospel of Luke nor the book of Acts contains an explicit reference that Luke is the author. But really, by the time of the first century, the end of the first century, the early church absolutely associated these books with the man Luke. Luke is the traveling companion of the Apostle Paul. Paul references him in several of his New Testament letters, and he is mentioned by Paul in every one of the letters that are called prison epistles. What is also true of Luke is that Luke is a careful historian. He is a very, very studious researcher. And we find this in the opening words of chapter 1, beginning in verse 1. Inasmuch as many have taken in hand to set in order a narrative of the things which have been fulfilled among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word delivered them to us, it seemed good to me also, having had perfect understanding of all things from the very first, to write to you an orderly account, most excellent Theophilus, that you may know the certainty of those things in which you were instructed. Luke's purpose is very clear. His desire would be that readers would know with certainty that the things they have been taught are in fact valid. This is not simply hearsay. This is not simply conjecture. But these are established facts upon which you can build your thinking. And I think it's important for us to pause right there and remember this. That Christianity is a fact-based, historically verifiable worldview. The events which are recorded for us here in the Bible, now more than 2,000 years old, considering these ones in the Gospel, they actually happened. And our faith rests on a foundation of factual events. That is a critical idea. It is accounts like the Gospel of Luke or the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and John, which form for us really the primary body of evidence for our faith. To what do we look to establish the ideas upon which we are structuring the entirety of our lives? We look to points of evidence given to us in the Gospels. Our faith rests not on ideas which exist out there somewhere. Our faith rests on events that are points of fact. They actually happened. And when you study these Gospels together, they will serve for you a real-time application. When your faith is called into question on a monthly, weekly, daily, hourly, the older you get, it seems like it becomes far more regular, that your faith is called into question. A study of these Gospels will serve you by establishing in you a certainty that what you were taught in Sunday school, or what you are taught regularly from the pulpit of this church, what you are taught is accurate and factual and rests on real events that occurred 2,000 years ago. So when you read the Gospel of Luke, Luke has a method that he is going to follow in order to give you information. And he writes to you like a careful historian or researcher would write to you. So what do historians and researchers do? They talk to people. So what Luke gives to you, in part, he gives to you accounts. Things that were communicated to him by others. Eyewitnesses to certain events who said, I was there and here is what happened. He doesn't take just one person's word for it. He verifies that. He does the necessary research. One reason why many scholars believe that Luke was the last of the three synoptic gospels to be written is because Luke uses the contents of both Matthew and Mark in the writing of his particular gospel as source material. If you were reading Luke, if it was a 21st century Western document, what you would see at the bottom of the pages are all kinds of footnotes. And it would say, see Mark, and it might give you a chapter or a verse to tell you where to look, because Luke borrows from Matthew and Mark for much of his material in his particular gospel. We know that Luke was a close associate with the Apostle Paul. As a close associate with the Apostle Paul, he has access to the church leaders who are still alive at the time of his writing. And we also know that Luke is in many ways an eyewitness to some of the events which he records in the book of Acts. So, it shouldn't surprise any of us when we read the book of Luke that the book of Luke is a document that is brought to us by very careful research and historical accuracy. It's likely that Luke was written probably sometime in the 60s, probably before the deaths of both Peter and Paul, because in all likelihood, if those deaths occurred, he includes that in his writing of the book of Acts. As I mentioned earlier, the book appears to have been written by Luke to an audience that is primarily Gentile, people like the vast majority of us in the room. He is a Gentile writing to Gentiles. He's a native of the city of Antioch, and he is the only Gentile, he is it, among the New Testament writers. All the rest are Jewish men. And his writing style really bears that out. So if you look at the writing, for example, in the verses that we just read, they are very, very different from how a Jewish writer is going to introduce a topic or say hello to the people to whom he is writing. When he quotes from the Old Testament, he quotes from the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament. He doesn't quote from the Hebrew. To him, Aramaic seems to be an unknown language. It appears that he is writing as a Greek man to Greek people. In addition to that, his Greek is excellent. If you were reading this in the original language, you would find that his Greek is superior. You know how when you read some people's writing, their writing just is better than other people's writing. It is, the sentence structure might be different. The vocabulary is broader. He doesn't use the same verb over and over again. Well, that's what happens in Luke's gospel. In fact, one critical scholar, somebody who is not in favor of Christianity, has said about Luke's gospel that it is the most beautiful book ever written in the world because of its style of its writing. So that's some background on the book. Let's consider a little bit the structure. How does Luke put the book together? By the way, every time we come together and we're looking at one of these books, we consider the structure. Because what I want you to understand is these men do have a method to their writing. They do not simply sit down with scroll and pen and say, let me think about this, and just begin to write whatever comes to mind. These are careful, excellent authors. And when you read what Luke writes, the structure comes out to you. You can see it as you read it. So what is the structure? Really, if you want to narrow it down to a word, the word is Jerusalem. Everything that Luke writes centers around the city of Jerusalem. You can see that very clearly in the events that Luke chooses to record in both the Gospel of Luke and the book of Acts. Think about it. In the book of Mark, the journey to Jerusalem. So remember, Jesus' public ministry, for the most part, has been up in Galilee, right? In the north part of Israel. He has to go to Jerusalem for the crucifixion. In Mark's gospel, the journey from Jerusalem, or from the north to Jerusalem, takes one chapter. In Matthew's gospel, the journey takes two chapters. In Luke's gospel, the journey takes nearly one half of the book, from the latter part of chapter 9 all through chapter 19. Luke focuses on the journey to Jerusalem. The book of Acts then focuses on the journey away from Jerusalem. So when you read the book of Acts, it leaves Jerusalem, eventually makes its way to Rome, the center of the Gentile world. And then from Rome, it literally goes to the four corners of the world. The result of that is this. The Gospel of Luke is the first half of a twin volume that Luke writes. He writes Luke, and then he writes its companion volume in the book of Acts. They really are telling one story. How the gospel formulates centering in Jerusalem, and then how the gospel expands as it leaves from Jerusalem. There are six sections that appear in Luke's gospel. Chapters 1 to 3 describe Jesus' birth, his childhood, his baptism, and his temptation. When you read chapters 4 to 9, there is recorded for us the early ministry that took place in Galilee. And then the whole gospel turns on one verse in chapter 9, verse 51, where Luke writes that as the time approached for him to be taken up to heaven, Jesus determined to set out for Jerusalem. Chapters 10 to 19 then chart that journey that takes him from Galilee to Jerusalem, and the teaching that he gives to the disciples along the way. They arrive in Jerusalem in the latter part of chapter 19. There, chapters 19, 20, and 21, Jesus teaches, and Luke records for us the Lord's teaching to the disciples on what it means to be a disciple of Jesus Christ. And then chapters 22 and 23 give us the trial, crucifixion, and the burial. Chapter 24, then, really is the fullest account of what Jesus Christ did in his appearances post-resurrection and his ascension into heaven. Now, you may say, well, you know, that sounds an awful lot like what we've already heard in Matthew and Mark, and you would be right. In fact, about 60% of the content of Mark's gospel appears again in Luke's gospel. And like Matthew, Luke also points out that Jesus fulfills all this Old Testament prophecy. So, well, what is it about Luke that is unique? Well, he makes significant, unique contributions, and they're very important for us to understand. For example, you see where Luke picks up Jesus' ministry. He does it differently than Matthew and Mark do. when Matthew and Mark jump into the public ministry of Jesus Christ, they come into it at a time when it seems that Jesus' popularity is kind of at a peak. And it looks like the people really like him. And maybe what's going to happen is something that's going to be very good for the people because they kind of like Jesus. That's what it looks like when you read the opening pages of Matthew and Mark. But that's not what Luke does. Luke takes you immediately into the time when Jesus is rejected by the authorities. And so the whole tenor of the book of Luke is very different than Matthew and Mark. The whole tenor of the book of Luke is going to be one of rejection. Look at all the opposition which Jesus Christ faces. His focus is not going to be to prove to the readers that Jesus Christ is the king. Instead, Luke's focus is going to be to demonstrate what kind of kingdom it will be. And it's going to be the kind of kingdom which experiences rejection at the very onset. And what we find out as we read Luke's gospel is the people that make up the kingdom are not the people that you would think would make up the kingdom. The kingdom of Jesus Christ is not composed of the cultural and religious leadership. In fact, what is true of them is they are rejecting him. That's what Luke points out. Instead, as Jesus makes his way onto Jerusalem, the focus that Luke gives us is on God's eternal plan to expand the kingdom way beyond what anyone really would think. And the kingdom of Jesus Christ is going to include all different kinds and sorts of people. And that really will be the theme that we consider as we work our way through the rest of the morning. There are four ideas here about the expansion of the kingdom. They are on your handout there for you. One, the kingdom is for all people, even outcasts. Two, the kingdom has no ethnic or geographic boundaries. Three, the expanding of the kingdom was the reason that Jesus came. And then four, the kingdom will continue to expand until Jesus returns. Let's begin with the first. As you may be aware, many in Israel really had been waiting at this time in the first century for the arrival of the Messiah. When the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his Son. Part of that fullness of time was this anticipation, this expectation that the arrival of the Messiah was on the horizon. And yet, the vast majority of people considered the arrival of the Messiah to be something that was going to be very, very different than what it actually was. They anticipated an arrival of the Messiah that would really mirror probably what was going on in King David and King Solomon's reign. That was very different than what was happening in the first century. In the first century, the people of Israel and the land is occupied by the Romans. That's not how it was in the times of King David or King Solomon. Instead of them being occupied, you'll remember that King David and King Solomon were occupiers. They occupied other lands other than their own. Their rules were vast. Remember what was said by the Queen of Sheba when she came to see King Solomon's court? I've never seen anything like this in all of my life. I've never even heard reports like this except yours. And the reports that I've heard about you are incredibly true. And they actually don't do justice to how magnificent your court is. Remember that conversation that she had? Okay, well, the people think that's what we're going back to when the Messiah comes. When the Messiah comes, we are going back to the heyday of what it meant to be a Jew in Israel. Well, now Jesus comes on the scene, and what he offers and what he presents doesn't look anything like that. And so it is fully understandable if this is the way of thinking by the Pharisees and the others who are critically in charge of keeping all things Jewish intact, why they would reject him. And Luke records for us one of these expectation-busting moments. look in chapter 7, if you would, please. And we're going to find that there's a conversation that occurs between Jesus and the religious leadership that really just begins to set on ear, on its side, the expectation that they have and the reality of what Jesus has come to do. So in chapter 7, beginning in verse number 36, then one of the Pharisees asked him to eat with him. And he went to the Pharisee's house and sat down to eat. And behold, a woman in the city who was a sinner, when she knew that Jesus sat at the table in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster flask of fragrant oil. She stood at his feet behind him weeping, and she began to wash his feet with her tears and wiped them with the hair of her head. And she kissed his feet and anointed them with the fragrant oil. Now, when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he spoke to himself, and this is really important. Here's what he said. This man, if he were a prophet, would know who and what manner of woman this is who is touching him, for she is a sinner. The rest of the chapter, then Jesus does this. He has a very pointed conversation with this Pharisee, his name is Simon, about the nature of sins and forgiveness. And what Jesus is doing here is he is pointing out that he's coming to earth and setting himself up on Israel. He was not here just to tap into the Jewish network. He is not hoping to be invited to all the important dinners. He is not looking to be viewed as one of the Jewish elites. He is not looking to become the leader of these Jewish elites. That is not why he is here. And what happens in this account is Luke records for us what this expanding kingdom is going to look like. And it shows us the kind of people who are going to be connected to this kingdom. It is going to be the very least who deserve the favor of God. Those will be the kind of people who get into the kingdom. When you read Luke's gospel, what you find is that Jesus has a very special concern for those who are the outcasts of the society, those who live on the margins, those who are the loners, those who can't quite seem to get and fit in with everybody else in the culture. And the reason that Luke points these out is because the commonality among all of these people is this. They are individuals who recognize that they are needy. And the result of that is they picture the kind of attitude that is necessary to become a part of Christ's kingdom. You have to be one who recognizes you are not all that, and that you are wholly and completely dependent upon God for everything in your life. People who live on the fringes, people who are marginalized, they tend already to have that point in their brain. I am not self-deficient. I am a dependent person. It is important to note when you read Luke's gospel how he sees Jesus' treatment of the poor. There are some theologians, liberal theologians, who look at Jesus' treatment of the poor and they say, see, poor people, they are especially blessed by God. But that's not what happens here. When you see the word poor used in either the Old or the New Testament, it may be a reference to someone's status in a culture. It may be a reference to someone's financial capacity. But it may also be a reference to someone's dependence upon God. Think of the Beatitudes. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for they shall what? What is it? See God. Who gets to see God? Not someone who is poor in his bank account, Not someone who is poor in his connections, but someone who is poor in his spirit. He says, I am woefully dependent upon God for my eternity. There is nothing in and of myself that I can do to obtain right standing with God. I am poor in spirit. Those are the kind of people who see God. So when you read Luke's account and you see him highlighting over and again the ministry of Jesus Christ to outcast people, to marginalized people, Luke is not saying, see, the rich and powerful don't get into heaven. That's not what he's saying. What he is saying is this. Those who are dependent entirely upon God, like the marginalized of society, are dependent upon others. Those who are dependent upon God like that for their eternal security, those are the people who are going to be part of the kingdom. Does that make sense to you? Question on that. Comment on that. All right, so let's look. Who are these marginalized people that Luke presents to us? One of the group that just stands out in Luke's gospel is the group identified simply as women. Luke does not exclude them, and far from excluding, as was common among the culture of the day, Luke reveals to you, as you read the Gospel of Luke, the prominent role that women play really in the life and ministry of Jesus Christ. Think about it. Right at the very beginning, he tells us in far more detail than Matthew does. Mark and John don't even touch on it, on the pregnancies of Mary and her cousin Elizabeth. And then we find out about the close relationship between Mary and Martha. We find out that there were women who played some kind of patron role in the ministry of Jesus. In other words, where did his money come from? Apparently he came from some women who had some capacity or who were simply sacrificial and provided the necessary funds for the disciples to walk away from their business and live for 3 years in some kind of way. Who did that for them? There was a group of women who played a part in that. You'll remember as you come to the latter part of the book of Luke that the first reports of the resurrection did not go to the male disciples, but it went to some females. The fact of the matter is this. Women were accepted by our Lord Jesus Christ, and women were very influential in the life of Jesus Christ. In fact, this is true. Luke records more women, makes references to more women than any of the other Gospels. That may say something about Luke, that's true, but it absolutely reveals something about what Jesus considered important. I think we should be encouraged by Jesus' attitude towards women. I think all the women in the room really should find in their Lord Jesus Christ the greatest friend and ally that you have toward your femininity. Think about that. You might be tempted to think that Christianity and that Jesus is really male focused because the disciples are all what? Male. And the Godhead is masculine. And only men can be pastors or elders. But beloved, there is not a male and female way of thinking about the cross of Jesus Christ. There's not a male way to follow Jesus and a female way to follow Jesus. The gospel really is gender neutral in that kind of way. In addition to that, if you men are ever tempted to think that you are of a superior role or greater position because of the gender which God has granted to you and gifted to you, you might want to spend some time reading in the book of Luke. Because there you're not only going to find out the attitude that Jesus has toward women, you know what you're going to find out? The greater examples of faithfulness to Jesus Christ come from the women, not from the male disciples of Jesus. There's another outcast group upon which Jesus focuses, and that is children. In our culture, children are often idolized. There is the reality, the sad case of child worship within our culture. That was not true in the ancient culture. Children were given very little concern at that point in time. So Jesus showing concern about them is very different. In Luke's gospel, we find Jesus healing them. We find Jesus receiving children to himself. In chapter 10, verse 21, Jesus reveals himself to children. He uses the children as an example. I tell you the truth, he says. Any who will not receive the kingdom of God like a child does, right, will not enter it. Chapter 18, verse 17. Jesus sees children as human beings who need him just as much as adults do. It is the whole basis for the reality of why we have children's ministries here. It's why we started a brand new Sunday school class today for our 2- and 3-year-olds, because we want to expose them to the truth of the gospel of Jesus Christ at the youngest age possible. We are concerned about kids here because Jesus Christ was concerned about kids there. And then our Lord gives special attention to the poor. You have to understand that the attitude towards the poor in the first century is incredibly different than it is for us in our culture. In the first century, there are no social justice ministries that exist. There are no places like up here in downtown St. Paul where you have ministries that are next to churches down there that provide daytime help and sleeping accommodations for people. That just didn't exist. So when Jesus tells the story about the rich man and Lazarus, that would be very unsettling to the hearers. Because both of them die, and who do you expect to go to Abraham's bosom? The rich man or Lazarus? Answer, the rich man. That's the one who should be with God, because look, his life is so obviously blessed. The one who does not go to God is the guy who eats the crumbs that fall off the table, the guy who his medicine, his national health care plan, his universal insurance policy is the dogs come and they lick his wounds. That's his insurance policy. Jesus tells the story and he says, here's what happens. The rich man, he opens his eyes and he's in torment. Lazarus, he opens his eyes and he is at the side of Abraham himself. You know the story. But had you been in the first century and you heard that story, it would have set everything on edge, because that was not how it was supposed to be. So when you see Jesus' ministry to the poor, what you see him doing is showing the expansion of the kingdom and the necessary attitude for everyone who is going to enter this kingdom. There are still two more groups of people to whom Jesus ministered. They also are outcasts of the society. He ministers to the sick. He ministers to the disreputable of the society. These groups are not simply marginalized in Jesus' day, like women, children, or the poor. These groups are outcasts. They are outcasts both physically and spiritually. So what you see in Luke's gospel is Luke provides a number of unique reports of miracles of healing that do not appear in Matthew and in Mark. You see Jesus healing lepers. It is in Luke chapter 5 that Jesus does the absolutely unthinkable when he touches a leper in order to make him whole. This is what Jesus is doing. But beyond the physical outcasts, Jesus is also very concerned with those who are called the sinners, those who are of ill repute in the culture, like the woman about whom we read a moment ago, the woman who is a prostitute. She is a sinner. Think about it. Among Jesus' disciples, there is one who is a tax collector. He would have been widely regarded as a cheat, a traitor to the nation. There was one among them who was a zealot. He may have been involved in terrorist activities. The zealots were looking to overthrow the Roman occupation. And he probably simply isn't a protester. He probably is active in his opposition to the people. These are those who make up. Consider the way that Luke tells us about the announcement of Jesus' birth. Every year, nearly every year, we see a little play up here, and somebody plays Mary, and somebody plays Joseph, and then somebody else has this little costume on, and then I remember when Jennifer was very little, Jennifer got to play one of the sheep one time in Midland, and she just all over the stage in her little sheep costume. And we have this idea about the shepherds from primarily our Christmas plays, that these shepherds are just these wonderfully nice people, and look what they do. But that was not the case. In fact, the reality is this, that in the first century culture, the shepherds are held in very, very low esteem. Here's what one commentator writes about them. We think of shepherds in terms of charming Christmas pageants with cute children dressed in nicely pressed robes. Yet in the ancient world, shepherds were thought of as shifty, untrustworthy, even thieving migrant workers. Go to some parts of the Southwest in the United States and ask a Caucasian his opinion of a migrant worker. Go to some places in Minnesota and ask opinions of people. What do you think of the migrant workers here who drive cars, drive cabs, or who work on yard crews? What do you think of some of them? That's the group into which the shepherds fall. And the Bible tells us that the announcement of the King of the Kingdom is made to them. And what is Luke showing you? Luke is showing you the kind of people who are going to be a part of this kingdom. So, the first characteristic that we see about the expanding kingdom, it is for all people, even those who are on the fringes of society. I have to go through these last two rather quickly, so please bear with me. The second point of expansion, it's not only all kinds of people, but it really has to do with ethnic boundaries. Right at the very beginning in chapter 1 and verse 32, we find that the coming of Jesus Christ is to be a revelation to the Gentiles. And the focus of Jesus' ministry in Luke's gospel, we will find, is not going to be to Israel only. This is in chapter 4, verses 24 to 27. But instead, we are going to find that sometimes even the Gentiles find special favor in God's sight. So what happens is this. Jesus tells the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that they would be rejected by God. And he says to the descendants of Gentiles, you will be accepted by God, Luke 13:29. And the issue is not one of ethnicity. That's not the point. This is the point that the Pharisees and the people think. What they think is because of my nationality, because of my ethnicity, because of my lineage to Abraham, I am all right. When Jesus says exactly the opposite. The Jews do not want the Gentiles to become a part of their kingdom because, frankly, they don't want those kind of people among them. And before we get too hard on them and pass such great judgment, I think it is important that we raise that question in our own minds in the same way that they, the ancient Jews, are protecting the atmosphere that they think they have. We don't want their kind among us. Has that crossed your mind at any point? Does it cross your mind with any kind of regularity now? Do you look at your church and say, I don't want that kind of person here? The challenge is recognizing that if I think that way, I am protecting and promoting an atmosphere which Jesus Christ opposed. Instead, what he is doing is he is expanding his kingdom beyond any kind of distinction or boundary save this. The only distinction that matters is, are you a children, are you a child of the light, or are you a child of the darkness? That's the distinction. There is no other. Third one. The expansion of God's kingdom is not just a side issue, but it is, in fact, as Luke 19:10 says, the very reason that Jesus came. The Son of Man came to seek and save those who were lost. Well, what would the lost look like? I don't have time to read it. You can jot it down. It looks like Luke 5:30 to 32, where Jesus talks about them being like a sheep without a shepherd. Who are the lost? The lost are anyone and everyone who have not believed on Jesus Christ and the truth about him. That's who the lost are. And Luke makes it a point to show that the mission of salvation is part of God's great plan to redeem all the nations from their sin. Jesus came to complete a mission. That's why you will find the word necessary over and again in Luke's gospel. You remember that in the previous one, when we were looking at Mark's gospel, the word immediately was the prominent one there. The prominent word in Luke's gospel is the word necessary. This is necessary to complete a mission. You see, beloved, Jesus did not come simply to make salvation available, to make it possible. He came to complete the mission of accomplishing salvation. It's not just something that might happen, it's something that did happen. His work done. Real quick. The Gospel of Luke paints a picture then, fourthly, that the kingdom is broader than the rich and powerful and the privileged. It's broader than a group of Jewish men or the nation of Israel. It gives us this idea also, that the kingdom of Jesus Christ is going to continue to expand until Jesus Christ returns. So this is why we look in Luke's gospel and you see an already but not yet idea. So someone asked him about the kingdom and where is the kingdom. And his response to him in Luke 17 was, the kingdom is wherever I am. And yet Jesus said in Luke chapter 22 that the kingdom is still to come. What does he mean by that? What he means by that is the kingdom is already here, but it's not yet fully expanded. It will continue to expand until the return of Jesus Christ. And really, it is that reality that was somewhat of a tension for the disciples. The idea that the kingdom is already here, but it's not yet come. This is why the book of Luke concludes with the Great Commission in Luke's own version of it. He tells them, the power is going to come from God to you. Wait here until it comes. And then we turn to the first chapter of Acts chapter 1, and we find him saying the power's coming. In chapter 2 it comes. And then the gospel continues to expand. And really the book of Acts then becomes for us not a history of the early church. The book of Acts becomes for us a history of the expansion of the gospel to the four corners of the globe. An expansion which is continuing until today. And in that way, I think the book of Luke can be something that's very personal for you. Because the book of Luke shows how an ancient doctrine, Jesus of Nazareth, how it weaved its way down through history and eventually arrives at your door and your soul. And it becomes very personal to you. I am included in the kingdom. You know what is true of me? I was an outcast. I was marginalized. I am poor in spirit. This is what is true of me. And Jesus Christ has saved me and brought me into his kingdom. Next week, we'll cover the book of Acts in anticipation. If you would read in anticipation, if you have a study Bible, if you have the notes in there, if you would read in that. I did not leave enough time for questions. If you have one, as always, send me an email. I like getting those. It's encouraging to get those. It knows that you've got something in your head that you want to ask, and I will do my very best to answer it.